Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we have been studying the Chula Vedala Sutta. This is Sutta number 44 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, and we've gotten as far last time we're on page 399. This is the section on the formations. We went through this section last time. In this, just to summarize, in this section, defines the three types of sankhara, three types of formation. There is the bodily formation, which is identified with in-breathing, in-and-out breathing. There is the verbal formation. These are the factors that are responsible for speech, for formulating speech. And this is applied thought and sustained thought, vitakka and vichara. Might also be translated thinking and examination. Because in order to speak, first we have to think and examine something, and then on that basis we utter speech. And then the mental formation, the citta sankhara, is perception and feeling. And that is because mind or all mental activity occurs in association with perception and feeling. As I mentioned last time, this section on the formations, on the three types of sankhara, is actually introduced in order to lead into a discussion on a meditative attainment, which is called the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. In Pali, this is called Sanya Vedayita Nirodha. I write that. Okay, so this is called Sanya Vedayita Nirodha, which means Sanya, of course, is perception, Vedayita is feeling, Nirodha is cessation. And in later works in Pali, this attainment is more commonly known as Nirodha Samapatti, which means simply the attainment of cessation. I think this is in Chinese, xiang shou mei ding, correct? Okay, now this is a very special meditative attainment. It's a very elevated attainment, which it is said it's only attainable by arahants and anagamis, arahants and non-returners. And only by arahants and non-returners who have achieved mastery of the preceding eight meditative attainments. What are the preceding eight meditative attainments? They're the four jhanas, and then the four formless meditations. That's the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, so in this sutta, we have now coming to paragraph 16, the question is raised, remember this is a dialogue between the bhikkhuni, the nun Dhammadina, and a lay devotee by the name of Visakha, who according to the commentary was formerly the husband of Dhammadina. And so Visakha asks Dhammadina how the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling comes about. And Dhammadina replies that when a monk is attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, it does not occur to him, I shall attain the cessation of perception and feeling, or I am attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, or I have attained the cessation of perception and feeling. But rather, his mind has previously been developed in such a way that it leads him to that state, it leads him into that attainment. This is pretty much all that is said in the Nikayas, the early texts, about how the attainment of perception, how the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling comes about. But later texts, like the Pali commentaries, give a more detailed explanation, which I think I find quite satisfactory. This is what the this is the way the commentaries explain the attainment of cessation. First, the meditator has to enter the first jhana. Then he emerges from the first jhana and then reflects back on the first jhana and contemplates the sankharas, the formations, the factors that enter into the first jhana as stamped with the three characteristics. That is, he contemplates the factors of the first jhana as impermanent, as bound up with suffering or as unsatisfactory, and as non-self. So he's doing insight meditation on the first jhana till he gets a clear perception of the three characteristics in regard to the first jhana. Then he returns to the practice of calming meditation and enters the second jhana. After abiding in the second jhana, he emerges from it and contemplates its factors with insight as anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent, bound up with suffering, and non-self. Similarly, he does this with the third jhana, the fourth jhana, the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, up to the base of nothingness, the third formless attainment. Then he emerges from the base of nothingness and contemplates its factors as impermanent, bound up with suffering, non-self. Okay, now there's one attainment that remains. This is the fourth formless attainment, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But before entering into this base, one makes a prior determination or resolution that one is going to enter into the attainment of cessation, or the cessation of perception and feeling, for a certain duration of time. And so it's said that one could enter into this attainment for up to 7 days. So if one is capable of that long duration, that long abiding in the attainment, one might determine 7 days. But it could be shorter period, one might make the resolution to enter into it for 1 day, or even 1 hour, maybe even 5 minutes. If that's possible, I don't know. Then there are certain other considerations that one has to make. I don't have to discuss them, unless somebody thinks that they're about to master this and wants to get some of the instructions. Then I'll refer you to the relevant book. Okay, so one makes the determination, I'm going to enter it into it, into that attainment for such and such a period of time. Then one enters into the fourth formless attainment. This is the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And the mind goes into the fourth formless attainment for just a few seconds. And then from there, it goes into the attainment of cessation, the cessation of perception and feeling. And then it will remain in the attainment of cessation and feeling for the predetermined time. So if it's 7 days, one will remain in it for 7 days. 1 day, one will remain in it for 1 day. 1 hour for 1 hour. 5 minutes for 5 minutes. And then when that predetermined time is fulfilled, then one emerges, comes out of it. And within this attainment, the attainment of cessation, then, as the name indicates, all sanya, all perception or ideation ceases, and all vedana, all feeling ceases. So it's a state, one can't even call it a state of mind, but it's a meditative state without perception and feeling. And yet, even though there's no perception and feeling within that state, somehow, how this happens, it's, I don't know how to explain it, but as soon as the predetermined period of time is fulfilled, one automatically comes out of it. This seems to be something that happens just through the nature of things. Okay, then the next question Visakha asks, when a bhikkhu is attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, which states sees first in him? The bodily formation, the verbal formation, or the mental formation? Okay, then Dhammadina gives the explanation. When the bhikkhu is attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, first the verbal formation ceases, then the bodily formation, then the mental formation ceases. Okay, what is the meaning here? Okay, when the monk is attaining the cessation of perception and feeling, in this process of attaining it, he first enters the first jhana, as I explained. In the first jhana, the five hindrances have ceased. But then he passes from the first jhana to the second jhana. In the second jhana, vitakka and vichara cease, that is, thinking and examination, or initial thought and applied thought. Applied thought and sustained thought. So applied thought and sustained thought, that is the verbal formation. And that is what ceases with the attainment of the second jhana. Then, as he goes on developing, practicing for this attainment, he'll reach the fourth jhana. When he reaches the fourth jhana, in and out breathing cease. For one who has attained the fourth jhana, there's no in breathing and out breathing. Then he next practices and goes into the formless attainments. In the formless attainments, there's no applied and sustained thought, no verbal formation, there's no in and out breathing, the bodily formation, but there's still perception and feeling. So up to the last formless attainment, there's still some perception, some feeling. But when he moves from the fourth formless attainment to cessation, then perception and feeling cease. So that is why the mental formation, which is perception and feeling, that ceases last. Okay, then the question comes, how does one emerge from the attainment of the perception? How does one emerge from the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling? Okay, similarly to attaining, as when to emerge from the attainment, one doesn't think, I shall emerge from it. One doesn't think, I am emerging from it. One doesn't think, I have emerged from it. But rather, the mind has previously been developed in such a way that it leads to that state. This is what I explained just a little while ago, that one has made the determination before entering into it, one has made the determination, I shall emerge from it at such and such a time, or after such and such a time has gone by. And because one has made that determination, that is called developing the mind or directing the mind in such a way that it leads to emergence. Okay, then the question arises, when one is emerging from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, which states arise first, the bodily formation, the verbal formation, or the mental formation? And the answer comes when one is emerging from the attainment, the states that arise just in reverse of the order in which they cease. And so when one emerges from the cessation of perception and feeling, first perception and feeling occur, and that is the mental formation. Then it seems as one emerges, perhaps one is going in reverse order through the jhanas, I don't know. But, okay, after perception and feeling have started, then the breathing starts again, and that is the bodily formation. One starts to breathe in and out. And then, as one descends lower, then thinking and examination or applied and sustained thought begin again. And that is the verbal formation. Okay, then the next question. I know this might be a little abstract, but we go through it anyway. Okay, when a bhikkhu has emerged from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, how many kinds of contact touch him? In other words, when one emerges from this attainment of cessation, the mind takes a particular object, and that object that the mind takes determines the nature of the contact. Now, according to the explanation in the commentary, when one emerges from the attainment of cessation, the object that one experiences is Nibbana. In the attainment of cessation, there's just no experience of any object at all. But when one comes out of that attainment, the first thing that the mind experiences is Nibbana, which is unconditioned. And Nibbana can be experienced in terms of either one of three qualities. It can be experienced either as voidness or emptiness. The Pali word here is sunyata, same as the Sanskrit shunyata. So one experiences Nibbana as emptiness. Or one can experience Nibbana as devoid of any fixed characteristics. This means that one experiences it as signless, without any fixed mark, fixed signs. Or else one experiences Nibbana as the absence of craving or desire. This is called the desireless. Okay, and so when one emerges from the attainment of cessation, then one experiences Nibbana either as voidness, as signless, or as desireless. And that's why it's said that three kinds of contact touch him: voidness contact, signless contact, or desireless contact. And which kind of contact is actually experienced, that depends on the individual. It's said that different individuals will experience Nibbana in different ways depending on their own personal temperament. And so the mind will focus on Nibbana in terms of one or another of these three characteristics. Okay, then it's said that when a monk has emerged from the attainment of cessation of perception and feeling, to what does his mind incline To what does it lean? To what does it tend? And what his mind inclines to? It said his mind inclines to seclusion, it leans to seclusion, it tends to seclusion. Because when one emerges from it, first one doesn't want to become involved in social interactions, because one has become extremely peaceful, extremely quiet, and so one wants to avoid first social interactions, and then one wants to return to the state of inner quiescence, seclusion from all mental disturbances. And so naturally the mind inclines to seclusion. Okay, maybe, though I said this is a bit abstract, but if there's any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Okay, George.
This is the first I've ever heard of a method to experience nibbana. It may have been mentioned before, but before it's always been an accident or a byproduct of some other state. Are there other ways of attaining nibbana than entering into this?
This isn't actually, you have to distinguish here, this isn't actually the attainment of nibbana. And also when we speak about nibbana, we have to, this gets to be a rather complicated subject. We have to distinguish the attainment of nibbana, which comes about through the practice of the path. So at one level, we understand nibbana is the destruction of the defilements, destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion. And then this comes about by the practice of the path. But there's another sense of nibbana, which is the sense that nibbana is an unconditioned reality. It's a state, a dharma, a state which is without any production, no birth, no transformation, it doesn't undergo alterations, and it's amata, it's deathless, without any perishing. So nibbana is this, and it's unconditioned because it's not produced by causes and conditions. Okay. Now this unconditioned state of nibbana becomes accessible to at very, very high levels of meditative experience, so that one who has achieved arhatship can enter into a special meditative attainment in which he'll be experiencing through the duration of that meditation, will be experiencing nibbana as the unconditioned. The mind turns away from all conditioned phenomena and directly enters into this unconditioned state. Now, the attainment of cessation, sannyavedayata nirodha, cessation of perception and feeling, is not identical with nibbana. It's not the experience. In itself, it is not the experience of nibbana, but it is a meditative attainment in which all perception, feeling have ceased. But when one comes out of that attainment, it is said that just for a few turns of consciousness, it could be just a few seconds perhaps, one will experience nibbana, and then one comes back to a more ordinary state of consciousness until one comes back to the normal functioning consciousness. I don't know if that makes it clear. Yes, in the back.
So is this to say that the Buddha and the Arhats are not continually dwelling in the state of nirvana?
Yeah, that's a good question, whether the Buddha or the Arhats are not continually dwelling in the state of nirvana. In the sense that nirvana is the destruction of greed, hatred, and delusion, they're constantly dwelling in the state of nirvana in that sense. They're not continually dwelling in the state where they are experiencing nirvana as the unconditioned. That only occurs in the special meditative attainment. So when they're going about their daily activities, talking to people, going, say, into the village on alms round, walking around, then they're not experiencing nibbana as the unconditioned. That only comes when they sit down for meditation and make that determination to experience nibbana. But in all of their activities, all the time, greed, hatred, delusion are permanently gone. They can never arise again. Yes.
Is nirvana associated with any one of the eight jhanas?
Again, this is a rather technical. let us, to make it somewhat simple, let's say that this meditative experience of nirvana is different from the four jhanas and the four formless attainments. It's a different meditative experience. Since the four jhanas will generally take something like a form as an object. It could be like the colored disc, you know, that forms the kasina object. Or it could be the breath as the object. And the formless attainments, they have their own respective objects. The base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. But this nibbanic attainment, it's quite a distinct meditative attainment. Okay, maybe we'll go on to the next section, a little more down to earth. Okay, now we switch over to a discussion of feeling. Okay, so now Visakha asks how many kinds of feelings there are, and Dhammadina explains that there are three kinds of feelings. These we've come across often: pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Then he asks, what is the meaning of these three types of feelings? What is pleasant feeling? What is painful feeling? What is neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Okay, then the definition comes: whatever is felt bodily or mentally as pleasant and soothing, or as pleasant and comfortable, that is pleasant feeling. Okay, so pleasant feeling can be either bodily, what we experience with the body as the base. For example, a pleasant bodily contact, then I experience a pleasant bodily feeling. Or it can be mental. The mental pleasant feeling is what we call joy or happiness. Okay, then painful feeling. Whatever is bodily or mentally felt as painful and hurting, or painful and uncomfortable, that is painful feeling. Okay, so there's bodily pain, if I stub my toe or hit the ground, that is painful feeling. And also there's painful mental feeling. That is, when I'm feeling sorry about something, sad, distressed, anxious, then there's painful mental feeling. So here we have to make a certain clarification that all feeling is a mental experience, that feeling is a mental factor. It's a chaitasika. But the feeling can either have the body as its base when we experience something mentally, but it's felt through the body, or else it becomes a mental feeling when the feeling arises based upon some mental state, either some agreeable mental state or disagreeable mental state. Okay, then we have a third type of feeling, which is the subtlest feeling, and that is the feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant feeling, and that is whatever is felt bodily or mentally that is neither soothing nor hurting. So when I feel something with the body, but it's neither painful nor pleasant. When I think of that's the bodily, neither pleasant nor painful feeling. And if I think of something mentally, but it doesn't cause me either joy or sorrow, distress or happiness, then it's mental, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Okay, this should be clear enough. But now the next series of questions sheds a somewhat interesting light on these feelings. He asked, paragraph 24, what is pleasant in regard to pleasant feeling, and what is painful in regard to pleasant feeling? Similarly, what is painful and what is pleasant in regard to painful feeling, and what is pleasant and what is painful in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling? And then the answer comes that pleasant feeling is pleasant while it persists. That the pleasant feeling, as long as it's lasting, it's pleasant. But when the pleasant feeling changes, that is, when it disappears, then one could say the pleasant feeling becomes painful. Though actually that's a little bit of a misleading statement. What one would say is that when pleasant feeling changes or when it vanishes, then often it will give rise to some pain or discomfort. We're sorry at losing the pleasant feeling. In fact, this is what triggers craving, because of craving, we cling to pleasant feeling, and we enjoy it as long as it lasts. But when the pleasant feeling disappears, then a pain arises, discomfort. And then we seek to get rid of the discomfort by finding some new object of pleasure. And so pleasant feeling changing to vanishing gives rise to the pain, and then the pain triggers the craving to recapture some enjoyable object that will give more pleasure. Okay, painful feeling is painful when it persists. All of you have no doubt experienced pain, and you know that when you're experiencing sharp pain, strong pain, as long as it's lasting, it's really painful. But what happens when that painful feeling changes and vanishes? What do you experience? If you're sitting in meditation with the legs crossed for a long time, then pain starts to arise. Then if you hear the bell ring and then you can unlock the legs, the pain disappears and then it's pleasant. Or else if you decide you can't keep the legs crossed in this position anymore, so you readjust the legs, then the pain disappears and is pleasant for a little while till the pain comes back. Okay, so painful feeling is painful while it lasts, pleasant when it disappears. Okay, then what about neither painful nor pleasant feeling? This is painful when there is no knowledge of it. It's actually, this statement has to be interpreted. Okay, as long as the neither painful nor pleasant feeling is occurring, it's always neither painful nor pleasant. But when there's no knowledge of it, it's not really painful. It's not actually painful, but it's said to be painful because having no knowledge of this neither painful nor pleasant feeling is a state of ignorance. And ignorance is what perpetuates our suffering. And so not to know, not to understand this neither painful nor pleasant feeling, this is said to be painful. But when one has knowledge of neither painful nor pleasant feeling, that knowledge becomes a building block leading to the attainment of insight or wisdom. And so this knowledge of neither painful nor pleasant feeling becomes part of the path leading to the achievement of true happiness. And in this way, the knowledge of neither painful nor pleasant feeling can be called pleasant. Okay, I want to move on now. Of course, the next subject is going to follow quite naturally from this discussion of feelings. And this topic, this next topic that is brought up, is the anusayas, the underlying tendencies. Okay, now there are three anusayas, three underlying tendencies. These three underlying tendencies, these are defilements that lie within the mind and that have this tendency to crop up, to arise. And what sparks the underlying tendency into activity, what provokes it, is a particular type of feeling. And there are correlations between the underlying tendencies and certain feelings. There are the three main underlying tendencies. One is raga nusaya. This is the underlying tendency or latent tendency to lust, to craving. And this underlying tendency to lust is said to underlie pleasant feeling. This means that pleasant feeling is the particular stimulus that provokes the underlying tendency to lust or craving into activity. Then there is the opposite underlying tendency. This is called patika anusaya, the underlying tendency to aversion, or we could say the underlying tendency to irritation. And this is correlated with painful feeling. So it's painful feeling that provokes or sparks off the underlying tendency to aversion that brings it to a state of activity. And then the third underlying tendency is called the avijjanusaya. That's the underlying tendency to ignorance. And this underlying tendency is correlated with neutral feeling, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, so that it's this neutral feeling which, when it is not known, when it doesn't become an object of awareness, preserves, sort of shields and protects the underlying tendency to ignorance. And so when we're not in a state of pleasure, not in a state of pain, we tend to settle down into this state of dull indifference, dull neutrality. And that state of dull neutrality is what preserves and protects the underlying tendency to ignorance. Okay, then paragraph 26, Visakha asks a subtle question, a series of subtle questions. He asks whether seems to me that the order of presentation has been mixed up in the sutta. It doesn't quite make sense. Anyway, I'll follow it in the order that has come down here, but it would seem more logical to rearrange it somewhat. But I'll have to take it in the order that has come. Okay, paragraph 26 asks, does the underlying tendency to us to lust underlie all pleasant feeling? But let me change it. I'll take it in the way that seems to me more logical. Instead of going from paragraph 25 to 26, I would go from paragraph 25 to 27. Okay, so what should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling? What should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling? No. Maybe it's more logical to take it in the original order. So let me follow the original order. Okay, does the underlying tendency to lust underlie all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion underlie all painful feeling? Does the underlying tendency to ignorance underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? And the answer given is no. The underlying tendency to lust doesn't underlie all pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion doesn't underlie all painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance doesn't underlie all neither painful nor pleasant feeling. You could see that then naturally this would raise the question, why is this the case? In what way is it that the underlying tendency to lust doesn't underlie all pleasant feeling and so on? In which case one would jump to paragraph 28. But then the question about abandoning comes in, which seems to restore the logic of the original order. Okay, so what should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Okay, quite logically, the underlying tendency to lust should be abandoned in regard to pleasant feeling. The underlying tendency to aversion should be abandoned in regard to painful feeling. The underlying tendency to ignorance should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Okay, that follows quite logically from what came before. Okay, now the interesting question comes, which seems to be connected with paragraph 26. Does the underlying tendency to lust have to be abandoned in regard to all pleasant feeling? Does the underlying tendency to aversion have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling? And does the underlying tendency to ignorance have to be abandoned in regard to all neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Okay, and now the non-Dhammadina explains that this is not the case, that each of these underlying tendencies doesn't have to be abandoned in regard to each type of their respective feelings. Then to indicate how this is not the case, how this is the case, Dhammadina explains, she says, here, friend Visakha, quite secluded from sensual pleasures and so on, the monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Now, the first jhana is accompanied by pleasant feeling. And so it's possible that the underlying tendency to lust can arise in regard to the first jhana. One attains the first jhana, one experiences a pleasure which is far superior to that of the senses, far superior to ordinary sensual pleasures. And because of that superior pleasure, one enjoys it. The mind delights in it, and one becomes attached to it and clings to it. In that way, the underlying tendency to lust has arisen in regard to the first jhana. But in the process that's explained here, she says, with that is through the first jhana, one abandons lust. That is, instead of clinging to the first jhana, one uses the first jhana as a way to develop insight. And then through developing insight to higher and higher levels, eventually one will reach the stage of the anagami, the non-returner, and one cuts off sensual lust. And going further, one reaches the state of the arhat, and one cuts off all clinging to pleasure. And with that, one completely abandons lust. And in this way, the underlying tendency to lust doesn't underlie this pleasure of the first jhana or the second jhana, or the third jhana as well, they have pleasant feeling. So instead of indulging in the pleasure of the jhana, one uses it as a basis for developing wisdom, and the wisdom cuts off the underlying tendency to lust. Okay, now to explain how the underlying tendency to aversion doesn't have to be abandoned in regard to all painful feeling. Okay, here she takes the case of a monk who wants to enter into the supreme, into the superior liberations of the mind. So he thinks to himself, when shall I enter and dwell in that base or that state that the noble ones now enter upon and dwell in? Okay, so in this way, he generates this longing, the strong desire for the superior liberations. And this longing, because one is not able to attain it yet, it gives rise to a certain feeling of displeasure. Sometimes it can be strong pain, strong sense of dissatisfaction. And this dissatisfaction, even dejection, is arising because of that longing for liberation. Okay, and so when that displeasure or dejection arises, there's an aversion present. This is the aversion towards one's limited attainments, one's limited skills, one's inferior state of development. Okay, but instead of remaining fixed in that state of aversion, one uses this longing for the superior liberations as a means for practicing more diligently. And as one practices more diligently, then one gains these higher attainments, these higher insights. And as one gains them, then one abandons aversion. And in this way, the underlying tendency to aversion is abandoned. And so one could say that the underlying tendency to aversion does not underlie that state of aversion. Well, it doesn't underlie that unpleasant feeling. Okay, then, with regard to the third feeling, this is the neither pleasant nor painful feeling. Here, in her explanation, she takes the case of a monk who enters into the fourth jhana. The fourth jhana is the state that has neither pleasant nor painful feeling. Okay, so this is a state of neither pain nor pleasure. Now, normally, the underlying tendency to ignorance lies latent in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. But in this case, the monk, based on the fourth jhana, he will develop insight. As the insights develop, unfold, then he cuts off ignorance. And so in this way, one could say that the underlying tendency to ignorance does not underlie that neither pleasant nor painful feeling of the fourth jhana. Maybe I'll ask if there's any questions at this point. Yes, please. What is your name? Yeah. Paul. Okay, Paul. Yeah.
An ahat experiences excruciating pain, which he can still experience.
Yeah.
Does not have the desire to get away from the pain. Yes or no?
Interesting question. What I would say, probably there is a built-in desire not to go on experiencing painful. He'll experience painful bodily feeling. There won't be painful mental feeling. But I would think that there's a kind of built-in bodily.
It would still make sense for him to want to get away from the pain.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly. So there would not be the vexation normally associated with a bodily painful feeling. But when he's in extreme physical pain, for example, if he has some serious illness, he's going to want to take some medicine, not only to come back to the state of good health, not only take some medication, which is going to restore health to the body, but I would think if the pain is strong enough, he might want to take some pain remover to alleviate the pain. This is my supposition. It's not that he's jumping to take a pain remover with if there's a little pain, but there can be states of excruciating pain. And naturally, one would want to be free from that. But I would think that an arhat would have an extraordinary capacity for enduring physical pain. But there can be types of physical pain which are extremely overwhelming. Somebody else had a hand up here. In the attainment of cessation, there's no feeling, so there will not be any feeling of pain.
Even from extreme outside stimuli, such as extreme heat or extreme cold,
yeah,
or a trauma to the body that would occur during, or would that take the meditator out of that state?
Yeah. Interestingly, it's said that at least certain types of traumatic events, when one is in the attainment of cessation, just naturally, a fire will not harm the body. A flood will not sweep the body away. I don't know about other types of trauma. If somebody enters the cessation while sitting on the middle of a highway, one wouldn't do that. But anyway, when it's inconceivable that something like that would happen.
There is an interesting story, actually, of the Chinese monk Xu Yun.
Xu Yun, yeah.
He was beaten by the communists. He's over 100 years old.
Yeah.
Beaten by the communists, entered into samadhi while he was taking the beating.
Yeah.
And, you know, survived the beating, which was a severe beating.
Yeah.
Such an old body.
Yeah.
And because of the effects of samadhi, while taking the beating, he, you know, fared pretty well through it.
He fared pretty well through it.
Yeah, he was still you know, injured.
Yeah.
But just the fact that he managed to live through that kind of thing.
Yeah, I would say that the samadhi will fortify the body in some way. Yeah, there's a story. It actually comes in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 50. And then the same story or variants on it is related in the commentaries. There was a monk, this is in the time of an earlier Buddha, who had entered into the attainment of cessation. Maybe he was in some woodland grove. Then some farmers came by and they saw the monk sitting in this state of cessation. And perhaps they felt his breath and no breathing. And so they thought, this monk has died sitting in meditation. So let us cremate him. And so then they piled up some hay and twigs. They built a fire, and then they put the body on the fire. And while the fire was burning, they walked away. And then the fire raged and raged and raged, but it didn't consume his body. the fire went out after some time, and then this monk emerged from the attainment of cessation, looked around, saw the area around him was burnt, and thought, well, a fire has taken place, but I haven't eaten for a few days, time for me to go on my alms round. He went into the village where the farmers were living, and then they saw him going an alms round, and they thought, this must be a ghost. We burnt that monk. We cremated him. And now he's come back from the dead. Okay. Any further questions? Okay, we'll continue. I want to finish the sutta. Okay, now we come into another discussion, which actually builds upon the previous discussion about feelings. But the theme of this discussion is counterparts. The Pali word here is patibhaga. Counterparts are things that have particular relations between them, close relations between them. And the relationship can be one of either opposition or of, you might call this complementariness. That is, two things, one of which complements or completes another thing. Okay, so the discussion begins with the question, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling? And then Bhikkhuni Dhammadina explains that painful feeling is the counterpart of pleasant feeling. And then what is the counterpart of painful feeling? Pleasant feeling is the counterpart of painful feeling. Okay, so pleasant feeling, painful feeling, these two are counterparts in the sense of opposition. One is the opposite of the other. Okay, then it should be asked, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling and painful feeling taken together? And then the answer should be given is that neither painful nor pleasant feeling is the counterpart of pleasant feeling on the one hand and painful feeling on the other. So we could say that pleasant feeling and painful feeling are two feelings which come at opposite ends of the spectrum of feeling, and the feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant, is the feeling that comes in the middle of the spectrum. And so, neither painful nor pleasant feeling is the counterpart of the other two types of feelings. That exchange isn't in the sutta, but it seems that it should be, in order to make the sequence more logical. Okay, then what is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Then the counterpart of neither pleasant nor painful feeling is ignorance. Here, ignorance is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling in the sense that as we saw earlier, the underlying tendency to ignorance lies latent in regard to this type of feeling, and it should be abandoned in regard to neither painful nor pleasant feeling. Okay, then what is the counterpart of ignorance? Okay, the counterpart of ignorance is vijja, true knowledge. Ignorance is avijja, lack of knowledge. And so the counterpart is vijja, knowledge, true knowledge. So this is, again, it's the counterpart by way of opposition. Okay, then what is the counterpart of true knowledge? The counterpart of true knowledge is vimukti, liberation or deliverance. Liberation is the counterpart of true knowledge in what I call the complementary sense, in the sense that liberation completes true knowledge. It's the consequence of true knowledge. It's through true knowledge that liberation comes about. Okay, then what is the counterpart of deliverance or liberation? And then the answer given is that Nibbana is the counterpart of deliverance or liberation. And here it might seem that liberation and Nibbana are the same. The way I understand it, vimutti here would be the event by which the mind is liberated from the defilements. That event that takes place in time at a particular moment in time when the defilements are destroyed. So that is vimukti, liberation. And Nibbana can be understood, or should be understood here, as the unconditioned. And that is, we could call this the precondition for the possibility of liberation. The underlying precondition for liberation to be possible. And it's also that which liberation leads into. So when the mind is liberated from the defilements, then it enters into the state of Nibbana. Then Visakha next asks, and here I think he's trying to catch or trick Dhammadina. He asks, what is the counterpart of Nibbana? And then Dhammadina replies, he says, you have pushed this line of questioning too far. You were not able to grasp or to understand the limit to questions. For the holy life, the spiritual life, is grounded upon Nibbana. It culminates in Nibbana. It ends in Nibbana. But then Dhammadina says to Visakha, if you want, go to the Buddha and ask him about the meaning of this. And as he explains it to you, so you should remember it. Okay, so then the lay follower Visakha goes to the Buddha, and then he relates to the Buddha his entire conversation with the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina. And then the Buddha says, Bhikkhuni Dhammadina is wise, she has great wisdom, and if you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in just the same way that the Bhikkhuni Dhammadina has explained it. Such is the meaning, and so you should remember it. And that's the end of the discourse. Okay, if there are any questions, anything on the discourse, please feel welcome to ask. Questions? Yes, Tom.
You mentioned in an earlier lecture about there's a certain ignorance that's related to either painful or pleasant feeling, which is really not this ignorance. I think it's more of a lack of awareness.
I think the ignorance that's related to related to neither pleasant nor painful feeling. Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, that is why ignorance is said to be the underlying tendency that's correlated with the neither pleasant nor painful feeling. That's precisely why, because the neither pleasant nor painful feeling is somewhat difficult to observe, to recognize. And so it tends to slip by, to slip through the threshold of awareness.
And this ignorance in this last section here, section 29, is more of a defilement of the ignorance here, I guess.
Well, I think the ignorance being referred to, it's the same as the general defilement of ignorance. It's not that there's two kinds of ignorance. This is the same as the general defilement of ignorance, but the place where this type of ignorance shows up most distinctly is in relation to this neither painful nor pleasant feeling. I think precisely because the pleasant feeling is quite conspicuous, the painful feeling is quite conspicuous, but the neither pleasant nor painful feeling is subtle. And so the ignorance can be lurking there without being detected. Any further questions? Eva. Wait, please speak a little louder.
Neither painful nor pleasant feeling is pleasant when there is knowledge of it.
Yeah.
But if you are in the middle, sometimes you turn from the pleasant to painful to pleasant. You'll be aware that it could be both. Why it is always like a, they define as a pleasant feeling.
Why is it defined as a pleasant feeling? The neither painful nor pleasant feeling, as I explained, it's actually not, as the name indicates, it's not pleasant even when known, and it's actually not painful when not known. It's always neither painful nor pleasant feeling. But what one would say is that to have knowledge of the painful nor pleasant feeling is pleasant, because knowledge is the state that leads to liberation. And so it's the having the knowledge of neither painful nor pleasant feeling that is pleasant, or we can say it's a cause of pleasure, a cause of happiness. Whereas having no knowledge of this feeling, of this neither painful nor pleasant feeling, is said to be painful, not because it's actually painful, but because being in this state of no knowledge is what perpetuates the state of suffering. And so this no knowledge means ignorance, and ignorance is what keeps us trapped in suffering. So that's why no knowledge of that feeling is said to be painful. That's the way I understand it. Any further questions? Okay, then we'll have to end for this evening. And next time, the next class, we'll have the next class on December 16th. But there'll be a lecture on December 9th, not me, but Venerable Dhammadipa, the monk from the Czech Republic. He's now at Dwangyan Monastery, and he'll come here on December. He'll be giving a lecture here on December 9th. And so he's very knowledgeable monk and very good speaker. So please come for his lecture on the 9th. And then I'll have a class on the 16th. And we will take the Kosambi Sutta. This will be Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 48. Okay, so we'll end for the evening with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sutta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.